and this is a major division between Anglicans historically and American evangelicals. The center of life in an English town is the church. The center of life in American towns was often the courthouse.
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm here with J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, is on vacation and preparing for his daughter's wedding this weekend. But J.D. and I are excited to be joined by Dr. Miles Smith. Great to have you back.
Oh, great to be with you guys.
Yeah, glad you're here, Miles.
So we had you on last year, episode 266, for those interested, to talk about Christian nationalism and theocracy. And I remember that we had to catch you at a conference in between sessions. We only had about half an hour with you, and we just knew our listener wanted more. So now is the perfect time with the PCA's Ad Interim Study Committee on Christian Nationalism having just released a partial report of its work. Now, they're asking for another year to more fully complete their study, but they've published a pastoral letter, a list of affirmations and denials, and constitutional and pastoral guidance. Miles, the PCA is a black box to JD and me. Help us understand what they've said. What's the big takeaway here?
Yeah, so I think that there's, first of all, just a lot to commend. As I've thought about sort of, I've read it. I think that I'm on my third reading. I'm reading it again right now, just so I can kind of get the kind of context of it. I think that it's really an attempt to kind of think seriously. And just right off the bat, I should know that Kevin DeYoung, I think, did a great job picking the members. They're all serious guys. I know some of them personally. I kind of know a couple of them professionally. But I think it's serious men trying to do a serious thing. And there's, I think, a real sense that we can say that every single major institution in the United States has been caught off guard by the cultural and political and social changes of, I'll say, the last decade. And so I think the PCA, the clerical leadership of the PCA recognizes that. I think that they shouldn't be faulted. That's not a particular problem to Presbyterians. I think I would say pretty much most major religious groups were caught off guard. So I think that they recognize that. They recognize that there's a digital media environment that is kind of offering ideas, both good and bad, to the laity. It's harder for churches to police that digital media environment than it was to police print media. I think obviously there is a real change, for better or worse, in American politics. I think that we're seeing kind of the final collapse of, I'll call it, the Cold War settlement. I don't know if that means the post-war settlement's gone, but at least the Cold War settlement is gone. A lot of the relative unity in American society, I think, was purchased by the Cold War. And so I think the committee recognizes those things. And it's just trying to sort of say, okay, yeah, we were all flat-footed. Where do we go from there? I think it's meant to be a pastoral document. It's the committee, the main members, there's a few advisory members, but the main members are all ruling elders or teaching elders in the PCA. PCA is a two-office church constitutionally, so you can think of ruling elders and teaching elders kind of sharing some pastoral responsibilities. Ruling elders do their fair share of pastoring. They don't necessarily do sacramental observances, but they do sort of pastor people, if we can talk about the counseling and kind of admonition aspects of pastoring. So I think that's what the document's meant to do. And I think on the whole, I would say they've done a good job. It's very honest in its pastoral tone. It's sort of looking at, hey, there's a bunch of stuff out in the ether that is changing for good and bad. There's some bad stuff that's coming with it. How do we go from there? So that, I think those are all commentary things to say about the report. Good, serious men trying to do a good, serious thing. And for that, they deserve to be commended. I should also just note that I think the PCA is the only major sort of conservative Protestant group doing anything like this. I don't think the ACNA is doing it. I don't think the LCMS is doing it. I don't think the Wisconsin Synod is doing it. So what I'll call the magisterial reform, magisterial reformational groups in the US, Anglican, Lutheran, and the Reformed, I think the PCA's the only group that sort of pursuing this. And so for that, they got there first. And so for whatever imperfections there might be, I think they can be commended for sort of stepping out and try to ask the important questions.
Yeah, why do you think that is? I mean, do you have thoughts about is it Reformed theology? I mean, I know you probably have thoughts, but
I mean,
I mean, I have thoughts, but I would rather listen to what you have to say about it.
So I
So.
think that the virtue of Calvinism is that it's action oriented. It tends to be the least sacramental of the major magisterial reformational groups. So I think that there's a work out your salvation impetus in Calvinism that maybe isn't there with Anglicanism and Lutheranism. So that's a virtue. I would say the vice of Calvinism, it's an action oriented a reformational construction. And so I think sometimes that Calvinism tends to overreact, perhaps more that overreaction is more in its DNA than Anglicans or the Reformed. And so I think that there's just a sense that Calvinists like to do, maybe more so than receive. And I think that you see that obviously in the Puritan legacy to a considerable extent.
But you've said the commendations. What are some of the shortcomings?
I think it's a document that's trying to do probably a lot, and I would say too many things. I feel like there's basically like four bugbears that conservative Christians are kind of litigating now, not just Presbyterians, Anglicans, and Lutherans as well. And so I'm, by the way, for any Baptist listeners, I'm not saying they're not Protestants, but in as much as kind of a historical kind of division between magisterial reform, the Reformation, and the kind of post-magisterial Reformation, I think that it's easier to lump those three groups in.
It's good to make that qualification. Our listener is right on the edge of converting from Reformed Baptist to at least the Lutherans, hopefully Anglicans. But so thank you for
Yeah,
that.
anyone who's thinking about coming straight from the Baptist Church, the Anglican Church,
Need some steps.
well, it happens a lot these days. So
Amen.
I think that there's a couple of questions that really have charged up, maybe for good reason, people in pastoral places. There's a real fear that I would say a sinful construction of race realism is infiltrating churches, parishes, and that would be worrisome. And so I think that's something to worry about. I think there is another question, though, which is the intersection of religion and the state. And so I think some people, especially older people, we will call them boomers and not all boomers, but may, if you've been growing up in kind of the shadow of the post-war settlement, especially if you're from certain geographies, you tend to think of anything that doesn't just sound kind of all American 1980s kind of Reaganism. You think of all of that as the same thing. And so I think there's actually a division between questions over illiberalism, post-liberalism, and questions over what gets called Christian nationalism, questions over establishmentarian and disestablishmentarianism, and questions over race realism. And so I think that maybe what's happened is, again, this sort of Calvinist tendency to act means that we are sort of gotta get all of this done right now. And maybe they'll be able to be successful. They may pull it off. I don't know. But I think those are really, there's three or four different questions that are kind of being litigated under this one rubric of Christian nationalism. So I think that's something that if I were on the committee, I'm not. So no one has to listen to me. But I would say, hey, I think we need to focus. Like, what are we actually trying to do here? That's one. The second is I think maybe a more fundamental question is, in as much as some of this stuff is about politics, Presbyterians are sort of more downstream from a strict two kingdoms division than Anglicans are. So we're, for Presbyterian listeners, Anglicans aren't canonically two kingdoms. It's not how we operate. It's not in our DNA. We have some sort of aspects of that, but it's not in our DNA the same way it is for basically American Presbyterians. So for American Presbyterians, they take, to their credit, separation of church and state seriously. If you take that position, then there becomes a question of why are ordained churchmen trying to figure out answers to political questions? It seems like a lot of this stuff is about politics. It's about, what does Aristotle tell us? What does Plato tell us? What does, and not merely pagan philosophers, but Christian political philosophy too. So, in as much as it's about politics, I'm not sure what the church actually has anything to do with those things as a Presbyterian. I grew up Presbyterian, and so I'm aware there's sort of a division there. It's called two kingdoms. And so, Anglicans don't canonically affirm that division that way. For example, the original Anglicans, of course, built a pretty theocratic provision into the polity that they control. The House of Lords
That's
is,
right. Still has bishops in it. That's
yeah,
right. There
bishops
were.
are still in the Lords. And so I think that in that sense, what I would offer to the committee is you really have to choose. You have to choose whether you want to sort of go down a strict separationist two kingdoms paradigm, or, and that's fine if you do. The Christian tradition, the Protestant tradition, has a throaty place for that. It's historically viable. No sweat off anyone's back. But if you don't want to do that, then you need to explain to people why you're sort of saying you're believing in separation, but you also want the church doing politics.
Well, and the magistrate to promote Christianity. I mean, that's, so if he's a magistrate, what does that look like other than something political, right? I mean, at least that's the argument as far as I can tell.
And so I think that there's a little bit of maybe wanting to have our cake and eat it too. Anglicans obviously are more theocratic by nature. We think the church is actually the center of the sort of ordering principle. Anglicans believe that the church is political. Obviously, it's why morning prayer and evening prayer are sort of the collected places where people associate rather than the courthouse. And this is a major division between Anglicans historically and American evangelicals. The center of life in an English town is the church. The center of life in American towns was often the courthouse. And so, in as much as there's that difference there, I think that people sort of have to decide which way. Now, there are some expressions of the Reform that look a little bit more like Anglicans on the continent. You can see that the Swiss Reformed. especially tend to look a little bit more like Anglicans in that regard. And there are Reformed thinkers who I respect tremendously, who I think would sort of be more the term they tend to use is ecclesiocentric. James Wood at Redeemer, Ancaster, who I respect tremendously, and Peter Lighthart as well. So I think some of it's sort of just, you can't have it both ways. You can sort of believe in separation and spirituality of the church, or you can believe in ecclesiocentrism. I think some of it's just encouraging intellectual honesty on sort of why communions would choose sort of the respective positions. And then finally, I would just say that I think some of this is an overreaction. There is a real tendency to sort of think the sky is falling, to think that none of this has ever happened before. One of the reasons why I love Anglicanism, why I tend to be a relatively happy Anglican, even as crazy as our province is that the best of Anglicanism has a really long historical memory. I get lunch with students sometimes here at the college. Some of them are pursuing holy orders, and these guys are they're aware of the long history. And you guys are both rectors, so the type of kid. And he's in some ways, I'm sure he's annoying, but he ends up being a great pastor because he knows every single intricate thing that happened in Anglican history. And so there's something about that that I think is actually worthwhile. There's a historicity to our tradition. So it gives us a long memory. And then finally, I was hesitant whether to say this, but I think that there's an Americanism amongst the Reformed that we don't struggle with. And I'm not saying that makes us better. Some of it might be circumstance. I think about the fact that our bishop, Nick, I'm not sure what jurisdiction are you? Are you Living Word or?
Christ our hope.
Okay, so Christ our Hope. So in both of our dioceses, we have relatively sizable numbers of men in holy orders who aren't Americans originally. Our bishop, for example, is a Kiwi. He's from New Zealand. We have a lot of DNA of the Church of Nigeria in our diocese. So what that means is I have to understand that on some level, I can't, as an American, make theopolitical rules for my dear Nigerian brothers and tell them how to litigate the intersection of religion and politics for this reason. None of my rectors have been shot in the backs by Muslim terrorists.
Yeah.
And theirs have. And I think that, and this isn't meant to sort of shame the Reformed at all, but it's the height of arrogance to think that a group of people who are part of a denomination headquartered and sort of centered in the American Southeast could necessarily dictate political theology to brothers in Africa. And I think what's interesting about that is, that, of course, there's a beauty in it because it means that I think we do take seriously this idea of sacramental unity. And Anglicans in America, I think I've realized this being an Anglican, feel united to our Nigerian brothers who fight Islam. And they think they're
Yeah.
fighting Islam, right? They don't think they're fighting like secular Islam, or they're like, no, they're Muslims and we're Christians. And that's a thing that makes people kill each other, and one of us probably needs to win.
Yes.
And so that would be just my final offering. I'm sure that any of the archbishops from Nigeria, if I were to go speak with them, I think they would have very strong opinions about religious groups that should not be granted religious
Yeah.
liberty.
Well, you remember, you may remember, you probably don't, but my Thanksgiving sermon on Thanksgiving Day
I do,
last
Dr.
year,
Cook. I listen.
yeah, that's right. I knew that you meant despite the wonderful cacophony of a million children in our church. I use, just to your point, Miles, an ongoing conversation I have with a dear friend who is a bishop in northern Nigeria, but I said, you know, here's a bishop that I heard speaking, and I laid out his expectation for sort of the culture transformation that would happen from the church out through you know, every strata of society, but certainly including political reform. And I said this came from, you know, a man that's as far from white Christian nationalism as you know, white American evangelicalism as you could get. And yet his convictions, I share his convictions for the hope that the church would have a 11, would be 11 for, you know, for society. Through, if not particularly through political means, whatever that may look like, with all peace and justice and humility and things. And to your point, Miles, is that the, you know, one of the precipitating factors of the entire question, I think, from my perspective, has been that, you know, when this consensus that you mentioned fell away, and then, you know, has been, you know, like Obama's referencing Lincoln's, you know, the arc of history bending in a certain direction that was always sort of subtly, if not overtly, anti-Christian morality, and people, you know, sort of lightly complained about it, but you kept voting for people who said they would do something about it, and then they didn't. And then when, you know, in the recent memory, when that consensus, for all sorts of reasons, was exposed to have not only it doesn't exist, but in fact was taking a dramatic turn the other way. And then you had Christians finally stepping up and saying, you know, no more, or this is too far. That's when this kind of bugbear, as you said, of Christian nationalism began to be used as a blunt force instrument to try to silence people. At least this is how I've observed it. Because as we've observed many times in our podcast, you know, being involved in the Episcopal Church, particularly at its sort of like at its sort of most politically active in the sort of 80s and 90s, you know, maybe even the 2000s, early 2000s, there was no separation of church and state, you know, you could even begin to conceive of with respect to the Episcopal Church and its policies, its theology. And so, you know, I guess maybe that is some of the Anglican distinctives, for better or worse. You know, I happen to be on the other side of the political convictions, but the idea that somehow you would have this intersection of the two as a negative was clearly foreign in on sort of liberal political policy in the Episcopal Church. And then, you know, it's only been recent when it's sort of, at the very least, the counterpoint has had a voice, you know, call it Trumpism, call it MAGA, call it whatever, that I think you know, the ascendant powers that had been accustomed to a docile sort of acceptance by a generally Christianized populace is reacting. Now, again, I'm not saying that has nothing to do with the report itself. I think that, like with you, I've read it through. I know some of the people, and I'm grateful for that level of rigor and thoughtfulness. And you know, I'm not Presbyterian, but I did appreciate also the generous exceptions for disagreement within the document itself. I'm as conversant as maybe your average Anglican rector on the different Westminster, the different versions of Westminster and the pre and post. And so but I certainly appreciate the difference between the English, you know, Civil War version and the American version, and the differences one could expect, and all of the things that went into the founding. And so we could talk about that. But what I'm more interested in, to your expertise, and then just to our general life as Christians, not Anglicans, in America, is sort of the precipitating cause, the hope for this type of kind of caution and allowance, for lack of a better word. And then, you know, what's but both the precipitating cause for the report, but also the hope for expectation of something like this in the life of a church. Like, that's kind of what would love your thoughts on.
Yeah, so I think the precipitating cause is an epistemological fracture that I think it's blamed on the internet a lot. I don't think it's merely the internet. I mean, so I'm from Charlotte and I go to Charlotte. I spend time with, kind of the type of people who don't probably frequent new right intellectual spaces or something. And so, and I when I come back to Hillsdale, I work with people across the conservative intellectual spectrum. So I know Claremont people, I know libertarian people, I kind of know a little bit of everybody. And what really strikes me is there's a very, I think it's a strange generational divide that really speaks to a lot of the precipitating cause. I'll give you an example, and both of you guys I know are kind of we'll call it broadly Southern, and so I think that in that sense we'll let Kentucky be Southern for today.
Well, Nick
I'm
grew up
from
in
the
Northern
great Commonwealth of
Virginia.
Virginia,
Oh,
so
that's right.
that's
Yeah.
right. Nick's a Virginian, so
He's from the district, from the that's right. So
so I remember thinking, when I was growing up, my granddad had my dad and I were just talking about this. My granddad had this seersucker jacket he wore, and when he got older, old people get cold a lot, so he'd always wear that same seersucker jacket, and I can't remember if it was khaki or blue slacks. And then when he got older, he'd get cold, so he put on a little red sweater underneath it. And I remember thinking, I want to be like that when I grow up, and I kind of still want to be like that when I grow up, quite frankly. Like, I want to wear my boat shoes and have my khaki pants and wear my seersucker jacket and kind of just be an old guy. I don't think that's the case for a lot of Gen Z people and boomer. I think that the idea of wanting to be like your grandparents, or the idea of seeing some sort of generational continuity, man, it's just not there. And so I think that some of that is because Gen Z grew up with digital media completely. I think I'm an elder millennial, so I remember before the internet. I remember before cell phones. I wasn't completely formed by this stuff, so I still have, I think, the epistemological framework of maybe my parents or even my grandparents. So I'll give you an example. If a doctor tells me you should do X, I'm like, oh, he's a doctor. He probably knows. And so you go do
That's
X.
1 mile. That's social distance.
I think younger people are innately suspicious in a way that I'm not. And maybe I need to be more suspicious. So what I'd like to do is say, and maybe this is where I kind of split the difference between the boomers and the zoomers. I think the boomer answer is that the zoomers are always wrong. And I think the zoomer answer is that the boomers are always wrong. And I actually think that they both probably could stand to learn from each other. And I think there's things at the intersection of religion and politics that are exactly like that.
For instance, what do you, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but what are you thinking?
I'll give you an example. I was thinking of this. I just watched on Netflix. I was working out. My wife knew people who were like not like full Gothard, but like sort of Gothard-esque. And so I was working, reading through these ex-evangelical memoirs, and so I said, I'm going to. While I was rowing and lifting, you can't watch as well when you're lifting, but I was rowing on my machine. And so I was watching the special Pray and Obey about the fundamentalist Mormon sect. And then I was watching the Gothard, or not the Gothard, the Duggar show, which I had never seen.
Right.
I didn't know who the Duggars were until I got to Hillsdale. That's what living in Charleston does for you. And so I realized that, like, I'm watching this. I'll use the example of the fundamentalist Latter-day Saint sect, and their religious freedom means that they get to do predatory stuff. So the claim of religious freedom leads to predatory actions, and it hit me right there. I think that I know Tymon Klein. He's a friend. He's an intellectual. He works at the intersection of a lot of institutions. And Tymon had written something, and I wasn't sure how I felt about it. But in that moment, I've been married for coming up on 2 years, and my wife and I want to start a family. In that moment, I thought to myself, man, if I was a local judge, local cop, I would not give a baker's poo about their religious freedom. I'm going in there and using the raw power of the state to bring justice. I do not care about their religious freedoms. And so I think that there's a certain person who says, well, wait, what about religious freedom? Or what if you do that to someone else? So there's always this qualification. And I think maybe that's where I'm in the middle. I think Zoomers might just be, you know what, forget it. We are using the power of the state. And they might be right to see that. And boomers are like, well, we shouldn't use the power of state about religion. And I think I'm somewhat in the middle because I think I can't say that I think that everybody should get religious freedom. I can't say that. I don't believe that. Like, I don't believe that religious freedom should extend to polygamists. I don't
Well,
think.
it didn't initially. I mean, that was part of that was how we got Utah in the first place, right? I mean, that was,
So I think of myself as in step with the 19th century American settlement. I think of myself as probably in step with a lot of the early 20th century.
But doesn't that happen again? We're just so grateful for your expertise in this in historical matters. But this still points to that breakdown. I mean, you were talking about your grandfather. I couldn't help but we just passed the D-Day invasion. Neither one of my grandfathers were in the assault, the initial landing, but both were in the Battle of the Bulge. And of course, depending on who you're following on Twitter, they use that as a reverent memory or an attempt to sort of say, the America that these people, the world order that these people fought for, looks nothing like at least some construals of what people are arguing we should be defending, right? And I think that this is at the heart of the consternation and the difficulty is that, for me, from a pastoral perspective, when we have the ability to do rectors forum again every now and then, when this Christian nationalist sort of bugaboo would come up. I would just present a thought experiment. I say, okay, well, I don't know exactly what you're talking about, but let's do a thought experiment here and assume that everyone here in this room has immediately been elevated to a position of relative influence and power in a political realm, right now, like from governor down to state senator to ambassador. And as a Christian, how will you govern and what will you do? And again, this is back to like local laws and things. Like, is tolerance, and again, this is. I'm mixing all sorts of different streams of thought, but if the prime virtue of sort of liberalism was tolerance as a blanket statement, then you have to allow for the Christian police officer in Utah or wherever to turn a blind eye. But if the height of Christian, love of neighbor was something like protected good and laws that would promote, true religion, as it might be said. Well, then you have a different conversation. And I think that's where to your division, some of the excesses of the kind of liberal experiment that have been exposed through religious freedom or sexual licentiousness or whatever the case may be, no borders, things like this, have made some people very angry, have been very destructive for certain groups of people. And again, I think in a Christian perspective, we have resources to mitigate the outright rage and vindictive anger, thank God. But certainly I appreciate at the very least back to the PCA's report, there's an admission that, I forget, I didn't have it pulled up in front of me, but that, some of these concerns are warranted. Some of the excesses are valid. And I think that's going a long way to acknowledge that we have a problem. Now, we may not, this may not be the final answer on it, but again, to their credit and to our discussion, it is something that is necessary and worth having. But no, I mean, to your point, though, I think that's where the real world example of, ideological liberalism and practical real world repercussions, like the TV shows you're mentioning, like the kind of evisceration of the middle class, like the, whatever the fruit there is, has proven to be unsustainable. And so, our hope, like when I talk about Christian nationalism, it's like, well, these are two distinct terms that need to be discussed, but hopefully are never separated entirely. I mean, because you want the Christian to be involved in a nationalist, kind of nation building project, and you want a nationalist, hopefully, to be a Christian. Been back to the Northern Kenya bishop. It's not an either or, and it's a both and. And how do we balance and navigate and sort of consider that is, well, part of what we're doing now, I think, part of what we're operating on. So.
Yeah, and I think that maybe to anticipate one potential criticism, and a lot of people would say, and I agree with these folks, 85-ish percent of the way, say, well, natural law can do this. If as long as we just have natural law sort of governed Republican order, we don't need the state to make religious judgments. And I think that's usually true. That's mostly true, but let me just offer this. Who's natural law? Like, who is actually making the call on this? Because on some level, when you say natural law and you trace it to Aristotle or Cicero, you're already using a Western paradigm, right? And so, and then if you say, like, well, I mean, how many of you think that exposure of infants who are sickly is natural? And well, most of us would say, well, of course that's not natural. Parents don't do
That's
that. Okay, well, so we're not Roman anymore.
right.
We're not Ciceronian. We're probably Christian. And then if I were to say, well, representative government or something like, well, then we're now into an English thing. So I think on some level, when we say natural law, whether we admit it or not, I think some of it's just having the chutzpah to be intellectually honest in our own moment. We all basically think that some sort of, broadly Protestant, loop in the Abrahamic faith. You can probably even loop in some forms of Islam if you really wanted to take it out. But Judaism and Roman Catholicism, there's a group of people who affirm a certain sort of way of thinking about natural, not actually think about merely natural law. We're thinking about natural law filtered through a group of people's articulation of it. And I think that being honest about that would be good for us, especially
Yes.
for people who want to say, I only believe in natural law. Okay, well, whose understanding of it?
That's right. Well, that was in part the a guy named Georg Hamann. He was a critic of Kant, sort of Kant and his, project of the religion within the limits of reason alone. In part, that was part of his criticism was just to your point, Miles. Like the Jesus seminar of the 20th century, like you're, whoever is describing natural law ends up describing something that's quite natural to them, or at least, reasonable to them, and might be totally unreasonable to another. But, he was, in my, at least in my read, the one who introduced me to the fairly consistent idea of the sort of books of reason and the book, this gets back to the Bible. I mean, for Christians, we say we have two books. We do have the book of nature, but we also have the Holy Scriptures, and to read them in concert is for the Christian the honest way of approaching the world, which of course is offensive to unbelief and offensive to people with other books and all the things, which we need to at least be, like Peter says, gentle and humble in our acknowledgement of that. But the idea that we could read one without the other, I think, has been an error that has pervaded or has persisted in the church at times. Just me and my Bible, or just me and the sort of Aristotle and the natural law, or whatever the case may be. And I think that what we get to live through is the end of what's been called, the sort of the liberal experiment. Now, I hope classic liberalism doesn't die, of course. I have no interest in returning to whatever preceded it, or certainly back to a theocracy or some sort of, technocracy or oligarchy or whatever. But I do think, like you mentioned, projects, at least in intellectual projects like the ecclesiocentric project, I mean, like certain forms of the post-liberal project, like at least the considerations of, okay, let's put all our cards on the table. Let's actually speak honestly and frankly about the limits of our own convictions with respect to quote unquote freedom, and the limits and the possibilities within the various arguments for a way forward, and try to work it out as peacefully as we can, you know, because I think the idea, you know, again, back to the boomers, you know, the world that our grandparents inhabited has rightly been pointed out had some serious flaws, perhaps, you know, and so there's been some correctives there. But at the same time, we have to live in this one and then raise children, or at least the next generation for the coming one. And some of the cracks are being exposed, and it's by God's grace that both the PCA and then hopefully other church bodies, as the Lutherans would say, will at the very least take up the challenge to acknowledge these cracks and hopefully bring something both of the gospel to bear on the in many cases righteous anger of a cynical and dissatisfied, you know, generation in some ways, but also you know, righteous conviction and hopefully absolution of places where that anger has soured and turned into something nefarious and dark. And again, I'm speaking, I'm sure I could be spoken to myself by someone, and that, you know, I have been as much. And I think, you know, this is the great challenge of the church in every generation, but I think, well, I don't think I'm grateful for people who have been thoughtful, you know, aware of history, hopefully not repeated all the various admonitions that we get to live by, and hope that there's more to come in this conversation as modeled by this document, not less, you know. So maybe our listener might be a bishop, so if he's listening, maybe he could commission an ACNA study group to come together and put something like this together. But I don't know. I mean, I'd say, I guess, still wanting to give you most of the words, the so the hoped for fruit of this, both in the short term, this particular document, but also just documents like these going forward, what do you see as their positive contribution?
I think that they set initial terms. I don't think this document will be the last one by any means. And so I think the hope is that it puts a good offering on the table and sort of makes important observations. Doesn't need to be, no one needs to get 100 on these things. And it's not a failure. Already it's not a failure. It's already a success in its own way. I can say it's a good document. If I was grading it, give it a B or something like that. I'm a tough
The
grader.
Hillsdale B.
That's
That
right. A
that's pretty
gentleman's
good.
B. So it's certainly not a disaster or anything like that. I think that, in some ways, as I read it with a distinct sense of envy. Am I impressed with it? Well, I don't know if I'm impressed with it, but it's good work. I don't know if you've ever played golf. You come off and you just want a cold beer, and maybe they've got like Yingling or something. And is Yingling the most magnificent, sort of crafty, amazing, 3 year age beer? No, it's not. But man, a Yingling on a cold day is great. And so, or on a hot day is great. And so that's kind of how I feel about it. I think my concern is that the ACNA doesn't even have Yinglings on a hot day. I don't know if we could pull off this, because I think that we have a prior problem. The PCA has largely worked through significant questions about its theology, and there's theological unity there, and for that they should be celebrated. I would commend the LCMS Lutheran Church on the same way. I don't even know if we've gotten prior theological commitments worked out for us to be able to work out a document like what the PCA has just put together. And so, in that sense, I'm envious of them, and I think I admire it. Not because it's the best thing, but it's like watching a guy who has two legs and two arms run, and being a guy who's maybe got, one leg and one arm, try to do it. I think that the ACNA needs to take care of serious ecclesiastical and theological stuff before we can even begin to think about those things. So I think that's a commendation to the PCA, right? Like, well done, you have enough unity to put together something like this. And Kevin DeYoung did a good job sort of bringing the tribes together. So yeah, absolute commendation from me. And so I think that some of it's distinguishing between the intellectual side of engagement with it, which I would be more critical. I'm in the ecclesiastical side, which I think is relatively good work. So.
We've been talking for 40 minutes now, and we haven't really said what the PCA has said about Christian nationalism. Is that because it's a wide-ranging document that's not clear? Is that because, well, are you able to sort of summarize in just a few sentences what they've said? And since they are first, it will probably be something of a template for conservative churches to come.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question, Nick. And so what they've said is, I think what Dr. Koch was getting at, that there are real debates that should be happening. There's obviously been changes that have happened in Christian nationalism, in as much as it's an attempt to address that, they understand and sort of want to have a conversation with it. I think the other side of it, though, is they're very concerned about what they perceive as a rise in race realism. And very concerned in temperate speech, not just by the laity but also by officers. And so I w and this isn't picking on them. They've asked for another year, which I think is to their credit. It means they're trying to be serious. Good for them for not rushing something. But what I would say is, I'm not even sure we still understand what Christian nationalism is.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it tends to be the kind of thing, it's like, forgive my French, but I forget who it was that said was that fundamentalist was dumb, some slightly more conservative than me. And so I think what Christian
Decide
nationalism,
whether we have to bleep that or not. We'll see.
so you can believe if you need it, but so I think what Christian nationalism is dumb SOB who is slightly more into political theology and more conservative than me. So I think it's still hard to define. And so it sort of depends on whose version of Christian nationalism. I mean, Charlie Kirk was sort of okay with claiming the term. I had a conversation with Charlie Kirk one time. I'm pretty sure that my conversation with a reformed person talking about it would be very different.
Yeah, it does seem that the, again, as I was reading through it, that the at least the great qualifiers are the intemperate speech. They want to make sure that people aren't, well, doing things online that they shouldn't be, speaking ways they shouldn't, unchristianly. And of course, my not suspicion, but my hope in that is that they could give us examples, if even if perhaps particular examples, of sort of, kind of guidelines, because, we have a similar sort of, there's some dioceses in the ACNA that have, quote unquote, pastoral, what's it called? The pastoral harm or something. And, I'm all for or against being pastors harming other people, but these terms undefined can be very squirrely. And then also, Miles, as you pointed out, there's a great concern and of course conversation that we've been a part of, well, for decades, if not centuries, but certainly acutely in the past 10 years about race and racism and white nationalism and ethnocentrism and race realism and all these things, which is a real It's a real complicated and challenging discussion. And of course, it has, there's historical antecedents that clouded. And I mean, it's a real mess. And I think they're right to acknowledge that these are the broad areas of concern and the challenges that we have to face. Yeah. I mean, I think that I still left wanting a clear, like, if you believe this, then you are a Christian nationalist, which is wrong. And if you don't, then you're within the bounds of confessional Presbyterianism at least. And that's a challenge. And I'm like you had on the last time, and this discussion has not abated, and the challenge is still in front of us. And I think that the more we can, in good conscience and good charity amongst each other, sort of have this discussion online and off, I think we're going to be better for it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I like about I'm just going to say I like about us, which sounds incredibly pretentious. The three of us should be the ecclesiastical triumvirate that governs all American Protestantism. But if you'll notice, we
It
just
could
had
be
this
the
conversation.
Cylons. That's
Yeah,
right.
we just had this conversation, didn't name call anyone. We didn't insinuate things about people. We didn't sort of say if you believe that X is going to, we were careful. And I think some of that's because, again, there's an Anglican button in us that thinks we can sort of think about this and we don't have to have an opinion. So I think we're all basically saying, you know, we want something to be said and declarative, and we want to know how to do it. I also think that there's something about our polity and about the way that I'll call it the sociological culture of Anglicanism, that we're sort of able to sit in this ambiguity for a little bit and just think about it. And I think that one thing I'm impressed by with the committee is it seems like there's a little bit more of that button in this PCA committee than maybe is normal for a Calvinist denomination. They seem to just be willing to kind of sit and maybe even stew about these really big questions. And so I think that there is, I've thought the same thing, Dr. Koch. Like, I just want you to tell me which of these bullet points in the description of X are the problem, so I won't do them. Or if I am going to do them, I will
That's
understand
right.
I need to break communion.
That's right.
And so, but I think what I'm hoping is the deliberativeness is actually sort of a virtue,
Amen.
on this. So.
Well, and I think at the end of the day, again, as a pastor, and I was asked this question, or at least it's been confronted. Anyone that's been in a pastorate hasn't been confronted by it. I don't know what sort of church you've been serving. But my sort of weekly inoculation to the congregation at St. Luke's when we did the rector's forum against being worried about being called a Christian nationalist was simply that, have they are they keeping the gospel in the forefront? Is the confidence that Christ is still king, a paramount in your life? Is the baseline of mercy and forgiveness still the tie that binds across believers? And so, it's like these are in place. Then the next consideration is, love of God and love of neighbor, which would look like various exercising outwardly concentric circles of responsibility from people you know and who have direct effect your life directly affects towards the abstract, across the globe, and to consider that in light of the and sort of the hope of the gospel will temper your speech and your action towards neighbor, in ways that we've been explicitly commanded to do. So, defend the hope you have with gentleness and humility, confront and correct the erring brother, with tears in your eyes and open hands. And to the extent that I haven't done that, I have been at times, lovingly corrected myself, but also pray and hope and trust that as we walk forward, that the Christian witness, to the extent that it's Christian nationalism, would be communicated in a, it's always going to be a offense to a certain, set of unbelief. There's going to be a reaction to, but there's also people who will see by our walk and witness and genuine concern for love of God and neighbor, something like an evangelistic appeal to God. I mean, that's my expectation. And so whether in these conversations, like the people that are outside the abortion clinic and with tears talking about their love of their mistakes in their own lives and their love of children, are markedly different in certain cases than the screeching, sort of condemnatory ones. The people that are arguing for whatever it is they're arguing from a spirit-wrought, mercy-bought, another rhymes, place of gratitude for what God has done for them in His Son is what Christian is. And then to the extent that it is manifest in the body politic through life, well, we hope that we would be something of salt and light, whatever that looks like. So that's, from my perspective, I mean, I'm interested in politics. I can't imagine being dragged into it explicitly, but at the same time, I pray that to the extent that I have any active role in deepening the Christian conviction of whoever is involved in the political world, then I'm grateful for that role and pray that the leaders that we have are convicted and faithful and seek to, again, love God and love neighbor through whatever means of responsibility they've been given. And we'll keep on walking and preaching and see what happens.
There you go.
Amen.
Well, Miles, I'm sure that we'll have you back on in a year when the study committee releases its full report so you can help us understand what they've finally said. But
I'm the Presbyterian translator,
there you go.
that's right.
Someone's got to do it. It's heavy work, but someone's got to do it. That is going to be all the time we have for our show today. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch, and a special thank you to Miles Smith. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.